Hi, this is Steve Nerlick.
Why cheap astronomy?
Yeah, why? And this is Dear Cheap Astronomy, episode 148, Space is Big and Dangerous. Astronomy is full of classifications and definitions, but it often has problems with boundaries. So, for example, where does the atmosphere end and space start? There is no real answer to this, apart from the fairly arbitrary Kármán line at exactly 100 kilometres above sea level. It's true that the air gets pretty thin at that altitude, but come on, we just picked it because it's a round number. And similarly, there's this problem. Dear Cheap Astronomy, how big is the solar system? There is no real answer to this one, apart from saying the solar system is as big as you decide it is. A simplistic definition that seems to work fine for most school children is that the solar system is composed of the Sun and its eight planets. But then you've got a million or so asteroids between Mars and Jupiter to account for, and if you're going to count small stuff like that, then there's probably an even larger number of dispersed objects out past Neptune's orbit, some of which we can observe in telescopes, and some we have even flown spacecraft past, at least in the region called the Kuiper Belt. But there is more. Even if we can't yet see them, we're pretty sure there are more distant objects still orbiting the Sun in a region we call the scattered disk, which is the source of short-period comets, like Halley's Comet, where short-period means anything that has less than a 200-year solar orbit. And following that same logic, we think there's also the Oort cloud, which is the source of long-period comets, such as Comet West, which has a solar orbit of well over 200,000 years, and hence has only been seen once in recorded history. It's thought the Oort cloud might extend out a light year or more from the Sun, potentially composed of trillions of ice chunks that are just barely held within the Sun's gravitational grip, and with most of them just staying in their very distant orbit and never coming closer to the Sun. So, that's one answer to how big the solar system is. It's the extent of the Sun's gravitational hold on things. So if there really is an Oort cloud of loosely bound ice chunks, then the solar system has a radius of about one light year. But that's not a very satisfactory answer, since the effect of gravity is essentially infinite, so the only thing stopping everything being held within the Sun's gravitational grip is other similarly massive objects exerting their own gravitational grip on things that surround them. So if you take that approach, there isn't really any such thing as interstellar space. It's just stellar systems all the way. That is, as soon as you leave one stellar system, you enter another. So a better alternative for deciding how big the solar system is might be to consider the heliopause, the boundary at which particles pumped out by the Sun, the solar wind, get pushed back by the interstellar wind, which are particles being pumped out by other stars and various astronomical phenomena such as supernovae and the polar jets from black hole accretion disks. This definition is helpful since once you are past the heliopause, you really are in interstellar space. The heliopause is around 18 billion kilometres out from the Sun, which is a long way short of a light year, but at least the heliopause is a lot further out than Neptune's orbit, which is just 4.5 billion kilometres out from the Sun. However, if you are thinking the heliopause is a big sphere with an 18 billion kilometre radius, no. Remember, the Sun is orbiting the centre of the Milky Way and completes that orbit every 225 million years or so, and does so by pushing its way through the interstellar wind. So the heliopause is more of a teardrop shape rounded at the front where it's pushing its way through, and then shaped into a tail at the rear. So while that front bit extends out to about 18 billion kilometres, the tail might trail behind the Sun for anything up to a trillion kilometres. Although if that sounds a lot, let's remember the hypothetical expanse of the Oort cloud is 10 trillion kilometres, and the ice blocks of the Oort cloud aren't greatly affected by the stellar wind, so they do maintain more of a spherical shape, as they are passively dragged around the galaxy in the Sun's gravitational grip. So, once again, the size of the solar system really depends upon your choice of definition, each of which has various pros and cons. But let's remember we do use that strange word system. Shouldn't that mean something? Those complex mechanical orreries, with the Sun at the center, with orbiting planets on sticks, moving like clockwork around it, looks to me like a system. And again, if you ask most school children to describe the solar system, they'll tell you it's the Sun and the eight planets. So, maybe we're just overthinking this one.
This is the middle bit.
It is sometimes best not to get too pedantic. The solar system is a whole bunch of stuff, big and small, orbiting the Sun. Enough said. But, moving on, not only is space big and defies borders, it's also dangerous. Dear Cheap Astronomy, just how dangerous are cosmic rays? Cosmic rays aren't light rays. They are particles, most commonly protons, in other words hydrogen ions, which are moving at high velocities. They are often called high-energy particles, since their speed gives them lots of kinetic energy, which is expended when they hit something. For example, a particle high up in our atmosphere, like a nitrogen atom. That collision creates a flash of light, and often what is called an air shower, being lots of minor particles, which are essentially the subatomic shrapnel blasted out from the original collision. Those shrapnel particles are also fast-moving and hence also have a high kinetic energy of their own and can hence generate even more collisions and more shrapnel. So, just one cosmic ray particle collision with our atmosphere can generate an air shower of subatomic particles up to a kilometre or more in diameter, meaning you get a falling shower of subatomic shrapnel, including pi and k mesons, and also muons. So, primary cosmic ray particles almost never reach the Earth's surface, but some of their secondary particles, the shrapnel, often do. It's estimated that several muons arising from a cosmic ray collision pass through your body each second. Having passed through at least 20 kilometres of atmosphere, with many successive collisions on their way down, their kinetic energy is much weaker than it was higher up. Nonetheless, these muons of cosmic ray origin are thought to be a significant cause of DNA damage, most but not all of which is repaired by our cells. Nonetheless, it's thought cosmic rays probably do shorten our lives due to cancer, as well as driving the mutation and evolution in all of Earth's life forms. If you're thinking it's just as well we have 20 kilometres of atmosphere between us and them, you'd be right. Passengers of commercial aircraft flying at 10 kilometres altitude are exposed to substantially more particle radiation than people on the ground, maybe 5 to 10 times more over the same time period, but fortunately, that's still not much cumulative exposure, since you are generally only at those altitudes for a matter of hours, and there is no evidence of greater cancer prevalence in aircrew or other frequent flyers. But once you're an astronaut, things get more serious, since you are higher up than aircraft travellers and likely to stay higher up for much longer periods. On the International Space Station, you will receive in 6 months the same radiation dose you might receive on the Earth's surface over 40 years. Things get even worse once you go out further, say to the moon or beyond, because you're out of the Earth's magnetosphere. On the moon, you'd probably get 3 times the radiation dose you'd get on the ISS. That might sound bad, but again, it's all about cumulative dose. We know for a fact that a few days on the moon won't kill you, and there's been no indication of heightened cancer incidence in any of the lunar astronauts, with Buzz Aldrin, Dave Scott, Charlie Duke, and Harrison Schmitt still hanging in there at the time of recording this. But for all of them, it was just a matter of days outside the Earth's magnetosphere, not months, nor the years that may be required for a Mars mission. Of course, out in space you also get electromagnetic radiation that can kill you, like UV, X-rays and gamma rays, but they may just be reflected away by the whole surface before they reach the crew within. Particle radiation is more dangerous because of the secondary shrapnel it produces. So a cosmic ray particle might hit the hull and create lots of secondary particle shrapnel, which might penetrate a layer deeper before they experience collisions, hence moving more subatomic shrapnel even deeper, and so on and so forth, until a final set of shrapnel, mostly muons, pass completely through the hull, giving the crew within a large dose of secondary cosmic ray radiation, with the potential to disrupt cellular processes and damage DNA. To avoid that happening, you need shielding sufficient to not just stop the primary particle, but to deflect or absorb all the secondary particles. There are some solutions on paper, but to get to them, we'll need to have a part two.
This is the end bit.
So, there you go. This topic is serious enough that not only do we need a part two, but also a part three. So you'll have to hang on for the next episode of Dear Cheap Astronomy to get the full story. Could we manage this in a less disjointed manner if we had more support through Patreon? Well, maybe. There's a Patreon link at the Cheap Astronomy website, or otherwise you could make a one-off donation there, or even buy a book. But that's it for another episode of Dear Cheap Astronomy. If you've got a space science question, or you're just tired of being asked for donations, why not write to cheapastro@gmail.com and we'll stop banging on about it. Thanks for listening, and thanks for donating to those fine folk who do. Steve Nerlich, Cheap Astronomy.